I think we ought to start, even though some people are still coming in upstairs. I'm Tony Giddens. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here tonight to this lecture, which is part of a generic series of lectures on modernity. I'm very pleased, of course, to welcome Mary Caldor, who has been a friend and colleague of mine for many years. So it's very good for me when she joined the LSE. She came to the LSE, I think, something over a year ago. And she's director of the program on global civil society, which is associated with the Center for Global Governance. She came from the University of Sussex, where she's taught for many years. She's the author of a number of famous books, most of which, I think it's fair to say, center around the area that she's going to talk about tonight. Among those are the Baroque Arsenal, a celebrated book in its day, really. I think you'd have to say Cold War book, but sort of crucial Cold War book. The Baroque Arsenal was the armaments which the two sides built up in the Cold War. Baroque because most of them were pretty useless, but they were ornate and they had a kind of surreal purpose, but not an effective purpose. This was followed by books like The Imaginary War, and her most recent book, which I must say I've made a lot of use of in lectures around the world because I think it homes in on some of the key things of the themes of the moment, actually, is called New Wars and Old Wars, or Old Wars and New Wars, I should say. So I'm very pleased to welcome Mary tonight, and the title of her lecture, as you might have guessed, is Modernity and War. Mary Caldor.
Well, thank you very much, Tony, and I hope this isn't going to be too repetitive from new and old wars. I thought I'd start by reading to you a quotation from George Orwell, which actually Sigmund Bauman makes use in the front piece of his book, Modernity and the Holocaust. And let me read it to you. As I write, he wrote this, by the way, in 1941. As I write, highly civilized human beings are flying overhead trying to kill me. They do not feel any enmity to me as an individual, nor I against them. They are only doing their duty, as the saying goes. Most of them, I have no doubt, are kind-hearted, law-abiding men who would never dream of committing murder in private life. On the other hand, if one of them succeeds in blowing me to pieces with a well-placed bomb, he will never sleep the worse for it. He is serving his country, which has the power to absolve him from evil. Now, I was thinking that last year in Yugoslavia, similarly highly civilized beings were flying missions over Yugoslavia. No one, I think, would condemn the pilots for dropping bombs or for killing civilians as a consequence of what is known as collateral damage. And I would include by that even the victims, who would not, certainly not blame the pilots. They would blame what can be collectively called, maybe not Britain any longer, but NATO. And this attitude towards the pilots is a very dramatic contrast to the moral revulsion that we all feel at what was going on the ground in Kosovo, the killings and the atrocities against the Albanians that were happening at the same time. Now, of course, this difference can partly be explained in terms of the goals of warfare. NATO, after all, claimed this to be the first war for human rights. They were doing their best to have a precision war and not kill too many casualties, too many civilians by mistake. The casualties were a side effect of the war. No doubt, the Yugoslav government would have made similar claims, even if we don't believe them. For them, this was a war against terrorism, and ethnic cleansing was a necessary tactic in the war. But I think there's something else which explains the moral difference between how we view the pilots and how we view the ethnic cleansers, and that something is rooted in modernity, and that's really what I want to talk about today. I think the NATO forces were, after all, the legitimate bearers of arms. They were obeying orders. they were killing at a distance which was not only a physical distance, they were 15,000 feet up in the air, so they didn't see the people that they killed, but it was also a bureaucratic distance. They were under orders. The decisions were made not by them, but by people in Brussels or Washington. It's interesting, actually, to note that the regular forces of the Yugoslav army also killed at a distance. Their job was largely confined to shelling villages. The actual atrocities were carried out by paramilitary groups and sometimes policemen, which were generally composed of criminals, often recently, some of them were recently released from jail for the purpose. What I want to argue, this notion of the soldier or the pilot as a legitimate bearer of arms, as a hero, in fact, in contrast to the criminal, seems to me one of the hallmarks of modernity. And in this lecture, I want to argue not only was modernity intimately linked to warfare, I want to suggest that if we're to deal with contemporary conflicts that mark a break, as I think they do, with what one might call classical modernity, the most important thing we have to change is this cognitive and moral way of perceiving war and perceiving responsibility. So that's basically the argument I want to make. And let me start by outlining the key characteristics of the relationship between modernity and war. And then I'll try to show how the wars of the 1990s marked a break with classical modernity, using Kosovo as an example. At the end, I will try briefly to set out what these developments could imply for future global developments and what, as it were, needs to happen if we're to make this cognitive change. Well, let me start with modernity. The rise of the modern state, as many people, including our chairman, have made clear, was intimately linked to war-making. What Norbert Elias calls the civilizing process, the process which involved the removal of violence in internal social relations within a given territory, was based on the monopolization, the concentration of the means of violence in the hands of the state, which to a large extent took place through war against other states. And essentially, I think, many people have described the process, particularly Charles Tilly, the process through which states were established, which involved the elimination of private armies, the regularization of administration and taxation and borrowing to pay for and organize war, the removal of violence from domestic relations so as to improve the efficiency of taxation and recruitment into war, and also to gain consent for war, the mobilization of national sentiment, the professionalization and regularization of security forces, the division between the military who were intended to fight wars and the policemen whose job it was to enforce peace domestically, the introduction of staff colleges, drill, training. I'll come back to that in a minute. I think the way I would put it is that through war, a kind of implicit social contract was established. This is a process lasting several hundred years, I should add. The notion of citizenship, of individual civil and later political rights, was gained in exchange for loyalty to the collective idea of the state and later the nation. The duty to fight for one's country and to pay taxes in war was exchanged for the right to domestic security in time of peace. So this was the kind of contract that was established through war. In peace, citizens could act as individuals, and they could participate in civil society. In war, they became part of the collectivity of the nation. War was a critical element in the narrative of the modern state. The imagined communities around which nations were built, which Benedict Anderson talked about, were often forged through the mobilization of sentiment in war. Now, that's why battles, that's why victories in war play such an important part in national narratives. The moral difference between the way we perceive war between states and the way we perceive violence for private gain, which we call criminality, or non-state violence for political gain, which we call terror, is all part of this process that we associate with modernity. Let me just quote Elias. "There's a very sharp distinction between the standard of civilized behavior in domestic as distinct from international relations. In domestic relations, violence among people is taboo and wherever possible punished. In international relations, a different standard prevails. Every larger state continuously prepares for acts of violence against other states. And when such acts of violence are carried out, those who carry them out are often held in high esteem." The Civilizing Process was first published in 1939, his book, and it was rightly full of gloom about where the project of modernity would end. He foresaw no limit to what was acceptable outside the state, as it were, by states, the use of violence by states against states. And it was not just that the modern period involved this sharp distinction between domestic peace and external war. Actually, of course, war has to take place somewhere. So in a way, even that was kind of an analytical distinction. I think a better distinction was between peace as the realm of the individual and war as the realm of the collectivity. But it was also the way in which we perceived war. War became legitimate, and indeed it became a rational way to pursue state interests. When diplomacy failed, the resort to war was considered a rational act. The pursuit of politics by other means, as Clausewitz famously said. So war was conceived somehow as something that was perfectly acceptable in the international arena, in contrast to the use of violence in the domestic arena. Now, I think war was conceived as a conflict between the military forces of opposing states, in which the decisive encounter was battle. The soldier, as I said, became the legitimate bearer of arms, the agent of the state. Soldiers were organized in vertical command systems. The structures were clear, and so were the lines of authority. They were trained and drilled to operate only under orders. And in theory, they were confined by various codes of conduct and laws of war, which were actually essential to the concept of legitimacy. There's a very fine line, a point that I keep emphasizing, between a hero and a criminal, between a soldier and a murderer. And the laws of war that were codified in the late 19th century were part of the ways in which the laws of war, in which you had to minimize civilian casualties, in which you had all sorts of rules about how you treated prisoners and enemies, were actually part of this process of establishing the legitimacy of the soldier. Of course, the laws of war always included this very important escape clause, military necessity permitting. And since war was a rational act, military necessity always overrode, always took precedence over these rules of conduct. And I wanted again to read to you from the Israeli military historian Van Creffelt. "To distinguish war from crime, it was defined as something waged by sovereign states and by them alone. Soldiers were defined as personnel licensed to engage in armed violence on behalf of the state. To obtain and maintain their license, soldiers had to be carefully registered, marked, and controlled to the exclusion of privateering. They were supposed to fight only in uniform, carrying their arms openly, and obeying a commander who could be held responsible for their actions. They were not supposed to resort to dastardly methods, such as violating truces, taking up arms again after they had been taken prisoner, and the like. The civilian population was supposed to be left alone." Now, Of course, an aspect of all of this was that war, in a sense, was compressed, not only in space, confined to the external, but also in time. Periods of peace alternated with periods of war. And wars, in fact, had decisive beginnings and endings in which the relative power of states and domestic legitimacy was determined. Clausewitz compared battle to the act of exchange in the marketplace, the determining moment in war. Now, the great insight of Clausewitz was that this definition of modern law contained within it an inherent logic of extreme. Whether it was because of the politicians' rational need to achieve their objectives, whether it was because the generals in such a case had to disarm their opponents, or whether it was because popular sentiment needed to be mobilized in the service of war, there was an inherent tendency for what Clausewitz called absolute war. And absolute war was only constrained by two things, by what he called friction, which was things like logistics and terrain, and the rational calculation of politicians. But I think those two things gradually became overcome, particularly in the 20th century. Friction was overcome by modern technology, by the discovery of rapid means of mobilization and transporting logistics and communications, railways, telegraphs, all of these things. And the rational rational calculation of politicians was swamped by the popular sentiment mobilized in the service of war. And so I think these extremist tendencies, which in a sense were a product of confining and concentrating violence, culminated in the First and Second World Wars, to the shock of all of those who had experienced the civilizing process up to 1914. So some 10 million people were killed in the First World War, and some 50 million people were killed in the Second World War. And it seems to me that what happened in this period, especially in the Second World War, was that those extreme pressures for absolute war broke through the boundaries between war and civil society. Total war, once war had become absolute, once it had become total, it was no longer possible to distinguish between the soldier and the civilian. Everyone was mobilized. As part of the war effort, national community took precedence over individual rights for the whole of society. It's interesting that the figures are very striking, and I'll come back to them when I talk about contemporary wars, but in the First World War, most of the casualties were military. In the Second World War, less than 50% of the casualties were military. And of course, those civilian casualties included the victims of the Holocaust. For Bauman, the Holocaust has to be understood as an outcome of modernity, not just because of the way it was carried out in a rational, organized, technological fashion, but because of what he called the moral sleeping pills of technology and bureaucracy. The distancing of the victims from the perpetrators, primarily through long chains of command, but also the distancing of the victims from humanity through this insistence on the idea of nation. The Jews were outsiders, they were foreigners, they were dehumanized, they were lice, and words like cleansing and hygiene that were to resurface again in contemporary wars, and again I'll come back to that. Bauman argued that the civilizing process, which involved the suppression of irrational and essentially antisocial drives and the gradual yet relentless elimination of violence from social life, was at the same time a process of divesting the use and deployment of violence from moral calculus and of emancipating the desiderata of rationality from the interference of ethical norms or moral inhibitions. Many of the same considerations, I think, applied to the mass bombing of civilians in World War II, as Orwell points out. The pilots were contributing to the collective goal of defeating Germany, or vice versa. The victims, as individuals, were morally invisible. Now, after the Second World War, we experienced the Cold War, which in a way sustained the idea of modern war in the imagination, but without actual fighting. It sustained collective communities based on ideology, freedom, socialism, rather than on nation. And it allowed domestic peace, domestic civility, if you like, to be spread across groups of nations. There were, of course, other wars. Indeed, it's striking to note that some 50 million people, the same number as were killed in the Second World War, have been killed in wars since the end of the Second World War. But by and large, because they were outside of the main Cold War confrontation, they were discounted. I think, in a sense, you could argue that if there was an implicit social contract in the wars of the modern period, the Cold War, in a way, extended that contract. In a sense, what people gained during the Cold War period was a greater degree of economic and social emancipation. To civil and political rights were added economic and social rights. But in exchange, they took part in an imagined war of completely unimaginable proportions, namely a nuclear war. Now, I think some of the wars that took place during this period really began to call that into question, and I'm thinking particularly of Vietnam and Afghanistan, that in a way started to break down that Cold War contract somewhere in the 70s and 80s. I'm not going to talk about this at length now, because what I really want to turn to at this point is contemporary wars, but I think you need to think about that as a kind of interregnum in between. Now, the first thing I want to say before I start on the contemporary wars is simply the fact that the typical wars of the modern period are, in my view, becoming an anachronism. It's actually not a very original view. It's the view of all sorts of people, like Martin Van Creffeld or John Keegan, quite a lot of military historians. But I want to say something about why I think that's the case, although to some extent it was obscured over the post-war period by the Cold War. One is simply the emergence of international norms in reaction to the wars of the 20th century. The principle that starting a war between states, unilateral aggression, is wrong, was actually adopted in international law as early as the Kellogg-Briand Pact in 1928, and it was, of course, strengthened in the post-war period, both in the UN Charter and in the reasoning in Nuremberg, during the Nuremberg trials. But I think along with these growing, if you like, international prohibitions against war, came the emergence of a new emphasis on individual human rights as a global phenomenon and not just as a national phenomenon. So in fact, the notions of human equality, the legislation about human rights, the idea which was begun in Nuremberg that individuals are valued in the human, in the international arena and not just the state, that individuals are also responsible for what happens in wars, and they shouldn't always simply, that individual responsibility that in certain circumstances takes precedence over collective orders. All of that came into being in the post-war period, even if we haven't yet, as it were, assimilated what it means. So I think that's the first reason why wars are becoming an anachronism, perhaps the most important. The second reason is simply the growing transnationalization of regular forces. You could say in a way that the concentration of force in the hands of the state, the absolute sovereignty that was represented by the monopoly of violence, was eroded simply by the integration of armed forces into all kinds of transnational arrangements like NATO, like alliances, like interchanges of military production and trade, like training, joint exercises, all kinds of arms control arrangements, which involves the presence of military forces on different, in different countries. So that in a sense, you could say, at least at a formal state level, there's a kind of process of global military integration, which certainly limits the possibilities for states to fight against each other. And a third factor, which, well, perhaps it's just as important, even more important than the moral factor, is, of course, the sheer destructiveness of military technology, which means that the typical way in which modern wars were fought, the capture of territory by military means, is very, very difficult and very expensive. This, in a way, was discovered in World War I and the stalemate of the trenches. But during World War II, that stalemate was broken through by the discovery of the tank and the aeroplane. I think nowadays, tanks and aeroplanes are as vulnerable as people were in World War I. So that when you do see wars between states, the typical pattern is what we saw in the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, or the current war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, which is a long-running stalemate with many, many deaths. And where regular forces do take territory, they seem to be only able to do it through total destruction. The pictures we've seen in the last few weeks of Grozny, the total destruction of Grozny to rubble, show the cost at which any piece of territory can now be taken militarily. So I think for all of those reasons, the sorts of wars that were absolutely typical of the modern period, wars between states, between opposing military forces, have increasingly become an anachronism. So what is the character of contemporary wars? I think contemporary wars have to be understood in a way as ways of getting around the impossibility of modern war. And I'm thinking we can point to two types of war, both of which were present last year in Yugoslavia. One is what I call a new war, which was exemplified by Milosevic's war in Kosovo. And the other is NATO's air war against Yugoslavia, which we've also seen in other parts of the world, particularly Iraq. So what I want to do now is to say something about both those types of wars. Let me start with what I call a new war. And I want really to make two general points. One is that these wars, well, they're often called civil wars or internal wars. And the reason that I object to this terminology is precisely because these wars involve a breakdown of the distinction between what's internal and what's external. They involve a breakdown between the domestic civilizing process and the external character of war. And I think there are several reasons why this is so. As a matter of fact, although these wars are often very, very local, they take place on a very particular piece of territory, they're also very global. And this isn't just because they involve a global array of actors, although they do. Most of these wars, if you observe them, will be peopled by international agencies, foreign journalists, foreign mercenaries, diaspora groups, various kinds of criminal trading networks, and so on. The list can be extended. But I think almost more importantly, because you can find wars in the mountains of Sudan or Afghanistan where you won't observe those people, they are wars that can only be understood in the context of global interconnectedness. And in a sense, what I would say is these wars are wars in which the process of state building of the modern period is almost exactly reversed. It's an unraveling of the civilizing process. I was thinking maybe one should call it the uncivilizing process. And you know, what you see is a loss of legitimacy, the decay of administrative apparatuses, often under the impact of liberalization and deregulation, structural adjustment, transition, whatever you want to call it. the growth of corruption and clientelism, and also the reprivatization of the means of organized violence. And these are factors that all feed on each other, just as in the reverse process, the growth of taxation, the professionalization of forces, all fed on each other in the early modern period. I call... now, where have I got to? I've lost a page. Because I had a third point, but I think it's here. I know what I wanted to say. I wanted to say that, if I can find the page where I wanted to say it, but I'll have to say it without the page because I can't find it. I wanted to say that in the case of Yugoslavia, this was especially true, that what you can see happening in the case of Yugoslavia was precisely a kind of unraveling of the state in the last years of Yugoslavia. Of course, it's true that Serbian-Albanian rivalry had a very long history, although it's not always true in many of these contemporary wars, but in this case, it happened to be true. But nevertheless, you can only understand the renewal of this rivalry in terms of the rise of a new kind of nationalism, which was true of both sides, but particularly true of Milosevic and the Serbian side, which has to be understood in the terms of a bid to retain power, as the socialist project, as the idea of Yugoslavia as a non-aligned state lost legitimacy, as the tax base shrunk under the impact of liberalization, which took place in Yugoslavia some 10 years before elsewhere, and as new kind of shadowy underworlds of criminal networks and mafia types emerged linked in to the government. In a sense, nationalism was reconstituted by Milosevic using all contemporary techniques in a bid to retain power. He used television in a way that was very different from an earlier period. If we think of nation building and the creation of imagined communities as being based to a large extent on novels and newspapers and print media, this new nationalism was very much based on television reaching out to the rural areas where people did not have the reading habit, and therefore it was a sort of powerful propaganda based on revival of history. And I think the other aspect of this new nationalism was precisely the opposite of the nationalism of the 19th century, which was a state-building project, which was an attempt to integrate. People in Scotland called themselves North Britons, rather like we like to call ourselves Europeans. In Italy, the idea of Italy was a created project to bring people together. The new kind of nationalism is exactly the opposite. It's fragmentative rather than integrative. And so that fragmentative process fed in to the erosion of the state. And I think the other aspect of it, of course, was that it was a transnational identity. And interestingly enough, I think this was particularly important on the Albanian side, where there was a very substantial diaspora that had links, that provided money, that provided satellite television for many Albanians, and that played a key role in the development of the sense of an Albanian national identity. So I think that one very key feature of all this was the unraveling of the state-building process, the emergence of a new kind of fragmentative nationalism that was at the same time transnational and rapidly mobilized through the electronic media. Now, the second point I wanted to make about new wars was the changed, if you like, mode of warfare. In place of violence between states, between opposing military forces, violence is directed against civilians. I mentioned the fact that in the Second World War, something like just over 50% of the casualties were civilian. That figure has dramatically increased in the post-war period, especially since 1980. And by the end of the 1990s, the ratio of civilian to military casualties is approximately 9 to 1. And it's not just that the violence is directed against civilians, it's also that a key feature of the new wars has been the explosion of refugees and displaced persons, that every war has involved, and the displacement of population turns out not to be a side effect of war, people fleeing the fighting, but a deliberate goal of the warfare. Of course, this was also true of the genocide of the Jews and the expulsion of the Jews. That has to be understood as a deliberate goal. And I think this violence against civilians can be understood in terms of an evolution of strategy that dates back to the Second World War. And you can trace it through guerrilla warfare and through counterinsurgency. Guerrilla warfare, revolutionary warfare, as articulated by Mao Zedong or Che Guevara, developed as a way of getting around mass concentrations of military force. The objective was to avoid battle because the guerrillas would always lose in a direct battle. And instead of controlling territory militarily, the objective was to control territory politically. Now, the way in which the guerrillas chose to do that was through winning hearts and minds. Of course, there was a certain degree of terror, but the basic idea was to win the support of the people in the territory which they controlled, and then to try to wear down the enemy through various forms of hit and run and attrition. Now, at that time, the guerrillas still regarded themselves as regular forces. They were organized hierarchically. They were, in a sense, quasi-state forces. They obeyed the rules of warfare. A friend of mine told me that she was researching the archives of the International Red Cross and found a letter from Che Guevara and Fidel Castro when they were fighting in the mountains, in which they requested the help of the Red Cross because they were unable in the mountains to treat their wounded according to the Geneva Conventions. So the response to guerrilla warfare was, of course, counterinsurgency. And what the British, the Americans, the French tried to do was to destroy this hearts and minds strategy, to poison the sea for the fish, to destroy the environment in which the guerrillas operated. And they did this through a whole range of destabilization techniques, which included forcible movement of people. It included flooding the area with area destruction weapons like cluster munitions, napalm, herbicides, and this kind of thing. Now, I think what you can say, without going into a long story, is what the new wars do is they make use of the guerrilla idea, the revolutionary idea of controlling territory politically, but they use the techniques of counterinsurgency to control territory not through winning hearts and minds, but through sowing fear and hatred. What they do deliberately is to get rid of people who will not support their political control, whether it's dissidents, human rights activists, or more usually, people of a different identity. And finally, I think the important point about this kind of war is that it's fought by a range of actors. It's not just fought by the regular forces. It's fought by paramilitary groups. It's fought by private security companies. It's fought by mercenaries. And instead of that vertical hierarchical structure, it's replaced by a kind of loose horizontal coordination of forces. The word, the fashionable word network, comes to mind, in which communications are very important, and in which technology is very important, but not advanced technologies, rather weapons that are cheap, easy to use, simple, so that even a child can use them. Now, I think, and the point is that in order to use, the aim is to get rid of people in order to sow fear and hatred, in order to control territory. And therefore, the way to do that is through the use of very conspicuous atrocities, through killings, through getting people, sending people away from their homes and burning their homes down so they never want to return, through systematic rape and the destruction of historic buildings so that people psychologically feel horrified and distanced by their homes. All of these things, in a way, the central heart of this warfare violates the laws of war as they were developed in the late 19th century. And Kosovo, of course, was an exemplary case of this kind of warfare. This was exactly the strategy which Milosevic was pursuing through his Operation Horseshoe in Kosovo. And as I mentioned before, the regular forces operated together with paramilitary groups. One of the most notorious of these paramilitary groups was a group called Frankie's Boys. And I mention this because it's also very typical that this was composed of criminals. They had very distinctive dress. They had a symbol which had the word city breakers in English. They wore they wore cowboy hats, skiing gloves. They had sort of Indian marks on their faces, all of which was somehow to dress them up for their activities. And I think, again, you find this very typical in the New Wars. The recruitment of criminals, the wearing of extraordinary dress, the smoking of marijuana, very typical, especially in Sierra Leone, the use of children who have not yet, who can be trained to overcome what Hannah Arendt called the animal pity which motivates normal human beings. All of that is a way of getting people against their will to engage in these kinds of atrocities. And you also see many of the things that you saw from the Holocaust time, the dehumanizing of the victims, the use of terms like, well, in Rwanda, the Tutsi were cockroaches. In Kosovo, the Albanians were rabbits and eels. Also historic terms. I mean, the Serbs were avenging the Battle of Kosovo, so the Albanians were Turks, so were the Bosnians Turks. Interestingly, in the Transcaucasus, where the Armenians fight against the Azerbaijanis are also Turks, not contemporary people who you know and meet every day. Now, I think the point about these wars is they're not a return to pre-modernity, in my view, because pre-modern wars were also hemmed in by all kinds of moral constraints. They're rational wars, and in a sense, they take it, you know, what Bauman was calling the emancipation of rationality from moral calculus to an extreme degree. But it's interesting that, you know, with this distinction made with regular forces and with this emphasis on the collective, legitimacy is never entirely abandoned. It's still collective, it's still killing at a distance. And it's interesting that, you know, you saw the same thing in Indonesia, this cooperation between the regular and the paramilitary groups. So I think you can still say there are residues in these kinds of wars of the modern period. Now, the airstrikes represented less of a break with modernity. If you like, they could be seen as an evolution from modern warfare, an attempt to resurrect modern war without casualties. It was war between states, war at a distance, making use of, to an elaborate degree, of advanced technology and planning and all of those things that were typical of modern war. You can see it as an evolution from strategic bombing in World War II through concepts of deterrence to attempts to make credible the use of military war, the use of military power. But in practice, in my view, the utility of the airstrikes was very questionable. It simply could not, from a distance, stop ethnic cleansing. You could not prevent the ethnic cleansing of individuals by bombing from the air. On the contrary, I mean, I think the problem with bombing is that it sets up this idea of the Serbs as a nation and, in fact, mobilized national sentiment behind Milosevic. It allowed Milosevic to crack down on NGOs and independent media, and it actually lessened domestic constraints against ethnic cleansing. Of course, in the end, Milosevic did capitulate, but only after a double ethnic cleansing, only after the Albanians had been through the terrible trauma of expulsion from their country, and then subsequently the expulsion of Serbs and the destruction of any idea of a multicultural Kosovo. Well, now, I really just want to come to the end at this point. The problem, it seems to me, about the airstrikes was precisely that they remained caught in the assumptions of the modern period. They were essentially war fighting. Although the air war was supposed to be a war for human rights, it was still based on exclusive categories of human beings. Western military lives were actually privileged over not only the civilian lives of the enemy, quote, but even over the lives of those civilians that the airstrikes were intended to help save. So among the civilian deaths, the collateral damage were refugees fleeing from Kosovo. And despite NATO's protestations that this was a war against the regime, against Milosevic, and not against the Serb people, that is not at all how it was experienced on the ground in Serbia. And what I think is needed is a rethinking of what we mean by humanitarian intervention, what we mean by a war. If maybe we can't even call it a war for human rights. Maybe there's a contradiction in terms of talking about a war for human rights. As I said, new wars break down the distinction between internal and external. They don't have clear beginnings and they don't have clear endings. Indeed, if my analysis is correct, that the new wars represent a kind of uncivilizing process, then the fear and hate, the kind of social relationships that are set up in the new wars, actually create the basis for subsequent wars. In fact, what the causes of the new wars arise out of the uncivilizing process and they're reinforced through the new wars. So the likelihood of war is even greater after war than it was before. And I think nor can those kinds of wars be contained in spatial terms. These wars, as we've already seen, they spread through refugees, through displaced persons, they spread through criminal networks, through the kind of informal economy that's associated with these wars, they spread through the virus of fragmentative nationalism. And I think you can say that it's not just something that's confined to outside Europe, where, if you like, the civilizing process was never actually complete. In fact, you can see many elements, many of the preconditions for these kinds of conflicts within our own cities, the privatization of violence, for example, the growth of private security forces, neighborhood guards, and all kinds of things like that, the emphasis on ethnic identity in among newly arrived migrants and networks of people. So, in a way, I think you can argue that the real danger is actually that what we will see, and probably the most likely outcome in the future, is the spread of this kind of warfare. And if we think of air wars of the Yugoslav and Iraqi type as a response, I think on the contrary, they reinforce those tendencies. They would reinforce the spread. You can imagine the new wars spreading, and you can imagine the air wars happening from time to time to reassure public opinion that we're deeply concerned, that we're doing something about it, but without actually having any real consequences. Indeed, exacerbating and reinforcing the tendency for these types of war to spread. So is there, I should say, by the way, that having given you this grim picture, I still think it's a less grim alternative than modern war. Maybe because I talked about the laws of war, I made modern war sound quite nice. But no one must ever forget the barbarity of modern war. It's unimaginable that 50 million people were killed in the Second World War. If you think about deaths in Yugoslavia, 200,000, that's the same as were killed, slightly more, on a single night in the bombing of Hamburg, Dresden, Tokyo, let alone Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But nevertheless, it's not a very nice future. And I think my view is the only alternative is to extend the civilizing process across borders, that instead of allowing the uncivilizing process to extend, we have to have a kind of global civilizing process. Now, I don't want to go in. We have to restore legitimacy. We have to restore the monopoly of violence, not simply on a state basis, but on a transnational basis. I don't want to go into details about how this might be done, because that would take a whole other lecture. But I just want to emphasize what it means in moral terms, which was the starting point of my lecture. It seems to me that if new wars break down the distinction between the internal and the external, between the soldier and the criminal, then humanitarian intervention has to be much more like policing, like global policing, than like war fighting. The aim of police is to minimize all casualties rather than to maximize the casualties of an enemy. Police have to operate on the basis of individual responsibility, arresting criminals and protecting civilians. They have to take initiatives in difficult circumstances. Now, what this might mean in the case of new wars is again a whole new subject, but I'm thinking of things like taking seriously the concept of safe havens, protecting, taking seriously the idea of international protected areas like the UN compound in Dili or the safe havens in Bosnia. I'm thinking of a sort of permanent and a growing international presence on the ground. I'm thinking of measures which are defensive, aimed at protecting civilians, rather than offensive, aimed at attacking the enemy. I don't want to go into details about this, but I want to stress that if something like this is to happen effectively, in contrast to the ineffectiveness, say, of the safe havens, it has to involve a cognitive change in the way we understand what's to be done. It has to involve, first and foremost, a real assimilation of the idea that all human lives are equal. And it has to mean that individuals have to individually take responsibility for the lives of individuals before, and this has to take precedence over your duty to some collective entity, whether the collective entity is the United Nations or Britain. If you take the example, I mean, this is very clear in the case of Srebrenica and Rwanda, which were classic cases where soldiers failed to protect masses of civilians, mainly because, and the UN recent reports make this clear, they were under orders from UN headquarters. They were told not to resist. The general in charge of Rwanda had a plan to save civilians, but he was ordered not to implement this plan. The Dutch asked if they could resist, use force. They were ordered not to in Srebrenica. And part of the problem was precisely this idea that the soldiers were part of a collective entity. They were cogs in a machinery, in an apparatus that was directed from New York and that was very far distant from the victims. And this seems to me what really has to change. I think peacekeepers have to think of themselves very differently. They have to take individual responsibility for the job they undertake. They can no longer see themselves simply as part of some collective entity, however that collective entity is defined. And that means they have to overcome essentially what one might call the moral impunity of war. The key point is, in a sense, restoring the moral calculus to the use of organized violence. And that's where I'll end.
Well, we've got a certain amount of time for questions. I believe there's a roving mic both downstairs and should be upstairs too. So, from the back there.
Glenn Siegel, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation, which as a practitioner of war, I tend to disagree with every point that you've made. I won't actually harp on them by giving you a counter lecture. I will, however, ask just one specific question. If I today was asked, standing in front of 100 British youths, to prepare them for a conflict in August of this year, in which British vital interests were at stake, not United Kingdom's, but British vital interests were at stake, how would I train them to actually go into conflict? And I'm not saying in terms of the actual warfare, but in terms of the psychology in the fact that they are and will be killers.
My problem is that I don't actually know what this contingency you're talking about would be. It seems to me that the new wars that I'm talking of are the main threats that we face today. Ooh, can you hear me? It seems to me that the new wars that I've described are, in fact, the main threats that we face today. I don't see any other threats. This question of where British vital interests is going to be threatened today, I simply don't see it. I don't see some external enemy attacking us. I don't see the main attacks that are likely to come, that are likely to be problematic to us, is the problem of incivility in large parts of the world, which could also affect us. And so my problem is that I don't actually know what you're talking about. If you ask me how would I train soldiers for, say, Bosnia, I would do it very, very differently. And I was very struck. I watched this program on the BBC on warriors, which confirmed my own experiences in Bosnia, where I actually did spend a lot of time talking to soldiers on the ground who felt the most terrible moral dilemmas. They felt incredibly frustrated that they were ordered not to protect civilians, that they were driving around, that their job was to deliver aid, that they were driving around in armored cars. Their lives were protected while they were witnessing the ethnic cleansing of ordinary civilians. They were told not to bring civilians out in their vans. They wanted to take individual responsibility, and the conflict for them between following orders and taking individual responsibility was incredibly agonizing. You know, we live in a world now where people more and more are increasingly autonomous, increasingly take individual responsibility, and my view is that has to be true of soldiers as well as ordinary people.
Okay. 3 points I would like to ask you. The first one is about this concept of new wars and how you reject this distinction between international armed conflicts and internal armed conflicts. One of the key points in distinguishing these two types of conflicts is that when you talk about international armed conflicts, you are talking about two states that are engaged in war. And when you are talking about internal armed conflicts, you are talking about a state that is using violence against its own population that may be engaged in war. So I think that this distinction, for the purposes of the application of the laws of warfare, is quite important. And I'd like to see what's your point of view about it. The second is the issue of the whole legal framework that, in my opinion, it seems to be, you have mentioned it, but it's not quite clear to me how does that relate at the end, you know, to the conclusion that you have reached. I mean, what's the relationship between this reality of war and, on the other hand, you know, the issue of the whole international framework when it comes to armed conflicts? And what the example that you gave about soldiers, I mean, in the law we find that, you know, soldiers are accountable, internationally criminally responsible for crimes, you know, and orders, if the order is unlawful, that's not a protection for the soldier. So how do you relate that concept, for example, clearly under international law established, and, you know, the sort of scenario that you are depicting? And finally, it's not very clear for me what's your definition of civilized versus uncivilized. And many people would contend that counterinsurgency methods are the product of civilized societies. You know, United States, Britain, France have developed these methods. So, you know, how do you see this dichotomy?
Well, three very good questions. First of all, on the internal, external point. Yes, I mean, it's true that these wars are very often wars by the state against civilians, but also they're wars, they're often competing parties to the war, both of them sometimes cooperating, sometimes conflicting against civilians. One may be the state, both of them may be non-state actors in some cases. Some may have a sort of claim to some kind of international recognition. How does that, so for me, I just find the distinction between internal and external not very helpful, because in these wars you may often have a whole range of external actors. I mean, it's very difficult to decide whether, for example, to take the case of Bosnia, was this a civil war or an international war? Whether you chose to define it as a civil war or an international war actually depended on your attitude to the war. If you defined it as a civil war, it was because you were against the breakup of Yugoslavia. If you defined it as an international law, it was because you recognized the legitimacy of Bosnia. And you can find similar sorts of cases. Now, when we come to the issue of what does that mean, this blurring of the distinction in international law, I think that's also very interesting, because in the case of Bosnia, it was civil war, said it was wrong to intervene. Those people who said it was an international war said it was right to intervene, because according to international law, it wasn't a question of intervening to protect protect human rights at that stage. It was a question of intervening to protect sovereignty. And attitudes changed between Bosnia and Kosovo, because the crucial point was not whether the repression in Bosnia was committed by a foreign force, in which case the laws of war applied, or whether it was committed by domestic groups, in which case you could say it was violations of human rights. The point was that terrible repression was occurring, and that's why humanitarian intervention was required. And what that means, implies to me, is that we need to rethink our categories in the contemporary world. In particular, I think there is a kind of coming together of human rights law and laws of war, which needs to be further developed as a framework for this kind of activity. And what was the third question? I've now forgotten. Oh yeah, I mean, of course, they were anything but civilized when it came not only to war, but to the colonies. The definition of the civilizing process, I mean, of course, there's different people have different definitions. I mean, some refer to good manners, to sexual repression and all kinds of things involved in civilization. For me, I'm really talking about the removal of violence from social relations, and the civilizing process applied to be within states, but it certainly did not apply to colonies and to and to external wars. It was very uncivilized. I was remembering today, actually, at lunchtime, we were talking about this, and there's this famous remark, probably most people have heard of it, of Gandhi, who, when asked what did he think of Western civilization, replied, "It would be a good idea." And so when I talk about, I've given this quite a lot of thought, and of course it's true that the most of what I've been describing applies to Western Europe. And in a sense, the civilizing process in terms of the removal of violence for domestic life was never complete in either Eastern Europe nor in what's known as the Third World. But my feeling is that something different's happened in the last 20 years, which is that there were always these efforts, these state-building efforts to establish a civilizing process. What's happened in the last 20 years is an unraveling of that, and that's why I call it the uncivilizing process. Yeah. Oh, Yetta. She's from Kosovo. No.
Hi. I'm interested in dimensions of peacekeeping, and that is two questions on this. The military tradition that in which modern armies of Western Europe are established, do you think it makes them less ready, and it is rather more destructive than constructive for these new missions in which they are requested to go now? And how do you see, do you think there will be it will need a whole new time and this new culture of peacekeeping to be built since Clausewitz's time? And I know it will be difficult to answer this question, but being from Kosovo, I'm extremely interested. If not the bombing, how do you consider that just some strategically, and what would have been possible to do for international community, that is considering what Milosevic would have accepted and what not also, of how could have troops, international troops, maybe come in and establish control? Could that be done without the bombing? Actually, I'm requesting what if scenario from you. What would you have done if you had been in, like, really a general of some army?
Well, first, yes, I think it involves a tremendous, I mean, that's in a way the substance of my whole lecture. I think it involves a tremendous shift in what the military is supposed to do, and that's what's really difficult for soldiers in a peacekeeping role, that they're simply not trained in this kind of activity. And interestingly enough, the British probably are better than anyone because of their experience in Northern Ireland. But some other European forces, the Danes, oddly, have sort of built on their experience in Bosnia to develop new doctrines. But it requires, I mean, I suppose the point that I'm making is it requires a very different military tradition. I mean, all of that has to be involved in training and equipment. But above all, it requires really thinking differently about what your job is. And that's the most difficult thing for the military to swallow. On Kosovo, I've got lots of answers to the what-if questions, but part of my problem is that it always depends where you start. I mean, I could see all kinds of different things you could have done in 92 or 93 when the international community lost interest in Kosovo, what you could have done after Dayton, what you could have done at a whole different stages. And in a way, by the time you reached the bombing, it was really, really difficult at that point to know what you could have done other than bombing. Although I still think, and I've been asking myself the question, you know, I still think, would it have been better if the OSCE monitors had stayed, and indeed if the West had sort of downgraded its demands to an upgrading of the OSCE monitors, you would have slowed the pace of ethnic cleansing, but would you have sort of frozen the situation and extended the situation? I keep asking myself that, and I don't know the answer. But I certainly think at an earlier stage, I think the big mistake, and in fact I was saying this all along, was to focus on trying to reach an agreement about status, which was impossible, instead of focusing on saying from an early stage we want to put people on the ground for protection. Our concern is not with status. Our concern is with the violation of human rights. And that, again, was a sort of cognitive idea that the international community were really unwilling to think about. And of course, it was not until December that they were even willing to contemplate putting troops into Kosovo, even on the basis of consent. And that was the problem that Holbrooke had, that the Americans didn't want to put troops in, the Europeans wouldn't put troops in without American support. So my feeling is, if at an earlier stage they'd focused not on reaching an agreement on status, but on putting troops there, and they'd been willing to put troops there, then the kind of strategy that I describe could have been a possibility.
I'm really sorry, but we've only got time for one more question because of time constraints, so I'll leave it to you, Mary, to choose.
I don't know if this question merits it being the last, so I'll split it into two parts. One, you were speaking about civilian casualties reaching a level of 9 civilians for every soldier killed in some of the most recent wars. But I'm wondering, at what point was that not ever the case? I mean, going to from Genghis Khan through the siege warfare of the Middle Ages through World War I, through Napoleon's scorched earth tactics in Russia, when were civilians ever spared, either on paper or in actuality, from the violence of warfare? And then secondly, if one sees NATO's policy in Kosovo as one largely of containment, stemming the flow of refugees and preventing a wider escalation of warfare in the Balkans and in other parts of Europe, how then is intervention continuing this process of decivilization, as you've called it, and setting up a situation where more of these new types of wars can emerge? You talked about kind of a vicious cycle where these new wars and interventions set up the situation where only more would evolve. But it seems like, at least in the case of Kosovo, the intervention was able to both stop the process and keep it from spreading. And while it's not, the situation there is hardly ideal and it's incredibly difficult, it doesn't seem evident how not intervening would have been more problematic or laid the ground for anything other than.
Okay, on the first question, I don't have figures dating back to Genghis Khan, unfortunately, but I do have figures dating back to 1900. And maybe I should have brought them to show you, but they really are very striking, that the ratio of military to civilian casualties in 1900 was was about 8 to 1. In other words, almost exactly the reverse of what it is today. So, you know, there really has been a dramatic increase, and I think what's really changed is that instead of civilian casualties being a side effect of war, they are the goal of warfare. That's what's really changed. On the other question, of course I'm not against intervention. On the contrary, I'm very interventionist. And I think one does have to intervene, and we have a global responsibility. It's just that I think airstrikes are an inappropriate way to intervene. And I think once you get in there also, you need a different way of thinking about these wars. I mean, the task at the moment is to rebuild legitimacy. And rebuilding legitimacy means, first of all, rebuilding a rule of law, which means doing policing jobs, which the military are absolutely unwilling to do. So in both Bosnia and in Kosovo, there are still widespread crime, widespread human rights violations. And secondly, it means building inclusive political project. And again, because of the way the international community think from above, even though they've changed over the years and they support civil society and NGOs, they always kind of negotiate with the leaders from above and in a sense help to legitimize these projects of ethnic partition. And as long as they continue to legitimize, and my view, these projects of ethnic partition can never work. They will always lead to further wars. And until they start really seriously thinking about building multicultural, multi-ethnic communities, you can't limit the spread of these wars.
Well, thanks to everyone for coming, and let's thank Mary again for a terrific lecture. Thank you.